Sue Meck was only 22 when she woke up in a hospital room without any idea who she was. She later learned she had suffered a traumatic brain injury in an accident. Sue Meck writes about her catastrophic memory loss in a new memoir. In this hour, we'll hear from her and from Leah Vincent and Misty Copeland. In Leah Vincent's memoir, she details what it's like to live in exile after being banished as a teenager from her family's ultra-Orthodox Jewish community. And Misty Copeland traces her journey from an impoverished childhood to her rise as one of the most successful African-American ballet dancers in the world. A midday memoir hour, next, after the news from NPR. And welcome back to Midday, our second hour. Dan Roderick's here. Thanks again for joining us. In this hour, we have three stories for you. These are the stories of three women, all of whom have written memoirs that we found fascinating. We'll hear from writer and activist Leah Vincent, who was exiled from her community as a teenager for violating the laws of her family's ultra-Orthodox Jewish faith. Leah Vincent is the author of Cut Me Loose, Sin and Salvation After My Ultra-Orthodox Girlhood. Midday's senior producer Nikki Gamer will be speaking with the world-class dancer Misty Copeland later in this hour. Misty Copeland is the only African-American soloist dancing with the prestigious American Ballet Theater. In her memoir, she traces her journey from an impoverished childhood to her rise as one of the most successful professional dancers in the world. To start off, though, we meet Sue Meck. In May of 1988, when she was just 22 years old, Sue Meck had an accident that changed her life. She was in her kitchen, playing with her then 8-month-old son, Patrick, when the kitchen ceiling fan came crashing down on her. The fan hit Sue Meck in the head, causing a traumatic brain injury. Sue Meck doesn't remember that accident, the one moment of her life that influenced everything after that. And that's because Sumek's entire memory bank was wiped out that day. When she woke up in a hospital room, she didn't know who she was. She didn't know who her husband was, or that she was a mother of two children. She didn't know much of anything. Sumek writes about the incident and its aftermath in I Forgot to Remember, a memoir of amnesia co-written with the journalist Daniel DeVise. Sumek, we welcome you to Midday. Thank you for making time for us.
Sure. Thank you for having me.
Hey, Sue, before we even get started here, you know, there's a Baltimore connection to your story, a Maryland connection. Could you just tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. The accident happened when we lived in Texas, but we moved to the Baltimore area in, I think, 1989. Mm-hmm. And we lived north of Baltimore in, like, Bel Air, Maryland area. Mm-hmm. And then we moved down to Montgomery County, Maryland, closer to Washington, D.C., a couple years after that. And we're there until just 2011. So.
And now you're in Massachusetts, is that right?
Yes, yes. I am going to be finishing up my bachelor's degree at Smith College. So we live in Northampton, Massachusetts, which is western Massachusetts.
Sue, what was it like getting this memoir together? You had some help here from Daniel, but I'm curious, how did you go about doing this, you know, the task of recalling, remembering, writing down in order to achieve this memoir?
Well, I didn't recall really things. I was mostly told stories from my own children, my husband, my parents, my friends that knew me before, my brothers and sisters. And then I just took all of that and wrote. Dan was great about doing the science-y things. He did chapter 3, but that was his thing because I don't really follow all the science-y neurology professor stuff.
Right.
That was his contribution.
you write in the book that I have found my life story varies depending on whom I talk to. And a lot of the time, accounts of a certain event don't just differ, but totally contradict each other. That must have been confusing for you, but I wonder, how do you even begin to put pieces together when there is that kind of confusion?
It's the same as putting a puzzle together, one piece at a time. I had to sort of, you know, sort through all of that. And occasionally I would ask somebody that I heard a different account from if tell them about another account that I heard. And they're like, oh, yeah, maybe that was that time. And then this thing that I remembered would happen at a different time. So, I mean, sometimes it just took a little bit of prompting, either my parents or Jim, or again, my kids were great about telling me stories about how it was growing up. Again, they didn't know any different. So this was a learning process for all of us.
Yeah. And Sue, there was a period after your accident. Of course, you didn't remember what happened before the accident. And then then you struggled with remembering things that happened the day before or the hour before. So,
oh, of course. That went on for at least a couple of years afterwards. I have zero memories of living in Texas and very vague, like the vaguest of memories of living in Bel Air. My first, I think, actual memories are from when we moved to Montgomery County in, you know, outside Washington, D.C., and that was, what, 1991, mm-hmm. You know, early 92.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. You mentioned years now. Is that did the memoir help in getting you to sort of assemble your life again to understand its chronology?
Yeah. That's what I did. I just have like timelines and notes and post-its and everything just all over my desk where I wrote, and like physical timelines that I have all written out that have different events that happen in different years, and that's how I think of things. I don't have a good sense of I think the traumatic brain injury sort of knocked out my sense of time. Like, I don't have a good sense of time, so things that are in the past or, I mean, I can't really think future, but things that are in the past, I have to, you know, attach them to something.
Mm-hmm. You talk about the two Sues, the two Sue Mex, the Sue the Sue before the accident and the Sue after the accident. So I guess I wonder, after all this time and working on this memoir, trying to move on with your life and moving on with your life, can you tell us a little about those two Sues, what you've discovered about the Sue before and the Sue after?
Well, the Sue before is, of course, a perfect stranger to me, with the exception of the stories that I've heard. She was kind of wild, irreverent, loud, argumentative. She was pushy. She was very, you know, center of attention kind of person. And I am almost exactly the opposite of that. I sit back. I'm an observer. I don't jump into things. I hate arguing. I don't do it very well. I think she was probably I think she was a lot more intelligent than I am now in terms of like IQ and things she knew and things she read. And, I'm still playing catch up with her a little bit that way. But, I'm kind of the opposite of that. I sit back. I don't like being the center of attention. I wait for other people to do something before I will do it. I don't always, you know, I'm not one to jump into the middle of things.
So. Boy, Sue, boy, you have been through a lot, including the fact that there were some doctors, I guess, some folks in the medical community who thought you were putting on an act for a time, that your condition was some kind of attention-getting scheme.
That's very frustrating to hear about. I didn't know that until I started writing the book. Jim told me about taking me to the neurologist after I was released from the hospital and, you know, trying to understand why it was that I couldn't remember things and couldn't remember faces of my children and couldn't remember my husband. And they thought that it was all just an act because they couldn't see anything on an MRI that indicated that I was, you know, that there was something majorly wrong in my brain. And I think it's frustrating to have the medical community say she's perfectly fine when he kind of knew that I wasn't, but yet this is what he's hearing, and he's, you know, 24 years old hearing this. If, you know, he's going to go with what the doctors are saying, and You know, it's like they didn't listen. They didn't listen. They didn't hear what I was saying. They didn't hear what he was saying. They just discounted it because they couldn't see anything wrong. And I'm hoping that this book, more than anything, will sort of give them a slap in the face and say, listen, your patients are not just making this stuff up. It's real, and every head injury is different. It's not like a broken leg that you can just set and, you know, see on an X-ray and then set, and then everything is fine after some time. Traumatic brain injury is different for every single person. The deficits that come out of TBI are sometimes very minimal, and then sometimes they're devastating. So, and you can't discount people that are telling you that this is what's going on in their lives if that indeed is what they're saying. So, yeah, that's an incredibly frustrating, and I'm kind of passionate about that because I think that would have been, I think things would have been a lot different if I had been paid attention to and maybe given some more support or whatever throughout all of that.
We received some comments on my Facebook page that, today when we told folks you were going to be on the show. One from Bev who said, life-changing victims are we who have traumatic brain injuries as a result of hit-and-run drunk drivers, yet ever so grateful we are to be alive. And I wanted to ask you a question about when you hear about the old Sue and the new Sue, which Sue you like better? I'm sure you're grateful to be alive. I wonder if you could go back and be old Sue, would you?
You know, certainly there are times when I think old Sue would do better in certain situations. You know, I can't really speak to that specifically. I am trying to be who I am and trying to figure out who that is. And, you know, graduating from college is like just the beginning, I think, of that. And, you know, it's hard to say one way or the other. You can't wish for things that you can't have. So I guess, I don't know. I try not to go down that rabbit hole too much.
Okay. But Sue, you said you're in college. Are you at Smith?
I am. I'm at Smith. I'm going to graduate in May.
Wow, that's great. And you've been studying music and book studies, is that right?
Correct.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And you plan to continue writing?
I'd love to. I've been sort of bitten by the bug. Writing this was probably the hardest thing I've ever done, plus going to school at the same time, which was just, you know, not recommended to anybody to go to school and write a book at the same time. Not recommended. But
right.
I've been sort of bitten by it because it's very freeing. It's very freeing to write down things that you don't necessarily wouldn't think about unless you were having to write them down. And I would love to write about my experiences here at Smith as not only a non-traditional student. We're Ada Comstock scholars are the non-traditional students here at Smith, but also as a non-traditional student, you know. So I'd like to write a second book. I have sort of in my head a whole series of children's stories that I'd like to write for kids of parents or friends or, you know, relatives of people with traumatic brain injury, because there's not a whole lot out there for kids. And you know, there are people coming back from the wars, there are people in car accidents, there are people, TBI, there's a lot of us out there. And I think it's hard to explain to a child that, you know, this person still looks like your mom, but she's not your mom anymore. Mm-hmm. Or, she, you know, she doesn't realize who she is anymore. And so I'd like to try my hand at that, too.
That sounds like a worthwhile project. So follow your bliss, Sumek. It's nice to get to talk to you even just briefly on the show today, and we really appreciated your memoir a great deal, one of the three fascinating books we'll be talking about in this hour of the show. It's called, it's a great title here, I Forgot to Remember, A Memoir of Amnesia by our guest Sue Meck, and it's published by, is this Prentice? No, I'm sorry.
It's Simon & Schuster.
Simon & Schuster. Well, Sue, thank you very much. I wish you good luck.
Yes, thank you. Thanks again for having me.
All right.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Sue Meck, what an amazing story. It's amazing just to hear from her again after what she went through. It was quite harrowing. Again, I Forgot to Remember, A Memoir of Amnesia by Sue Meck. We have to take our first break here of this hour, but when we come back, we'll move on to the story of Leah Vincent, a writer and activist whose family banished her as a teenager for violating the laws of their ultra-Orthodox Jewish faith. Leah Vincent's memoir is Cut Me Loose, Sin and Salvation After My Ultra-Orthodox Girlhood. She'll join us in a few minutes. And welcome back. Dan Roderick's here. Our next guest this hour is the writer and activist Leah Vincent. Leah Vincent was born in Pittsburgh to an ultra-Orthodox Jewish family. She was one of 11 children, the daughter of an influential rabbi within the yeshivish community, a fundamentalist sect of ultra-Orthodox Judaism. To adhere to their faith, Leah Vincent's family observed extra strict religious laws. They kept kosher, of course, but observed the Sabbath every week, but maintained a separation of the sexes, and to a large degree, they maintained a sense of isolation, too. So when she was caught at the age of 16, exchanging letters with a male friend, Leah Vincent was cast out from her community. Her parents, unforgiving of her sin, severed ties with her completely. She writes about that experience in a memoir, Cut Me Loose, Sin and Salvation After My Ultra-Orthodox Girlhood. In it, Leah Vincent talks about her life in exile, which culminated in the collapse of her faith. Leah Vincent is a board member of Footsteps, and she's the co-producer of the It Gets Besser project. Both undertakings help support people who have decided to leave ultra-Orthodoxy. Leah Vincent, we welcome you to the show, to the Midday Show here on WYPR. Thank you for making time for us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, I've read some reviews of your book as well, and they've said a lot of some positive things, as difficult it is to read some aspects of your story. For those of us on the outside looking into your experience, it seems like, you know, your transgressions as a teenage girl were pretty mild. And yet for you at the time, I guess you understood the offenses. You understood why this was happening to you. I wonder if you could go back to 16 and describe that for us.
Sure. So there were a series of violations or sins that I committed that sort of snowballed until I found myself cast out. It really started when I was 14, where I started to have some problems with some of the things that were accepted in my community. There was a pejorative that was used to describe African Americans that I found really offensive. But when I questioned the use of this word, I was silenced and laughed at. Or I started to become excluded from the conversations around my father because I was a girl, and the men, you know, would have these conversations, and I wasn't allowed to be a part of that. And that troubled me because I loved him, and I wanted to talk to him about the things he was talking about. Hmm. And so I was already, because of these things, already started to be viewed with suspicion. And when I was 15 and then 16, I met a boy who was an older brother of a friend of mine, and I wasn't allowed to talk to boys, but I was feeling a little rebellious, and he was really cute. And so we started chatting, and he encouraged me to think about going to college, which was forbidden in my community. And I told my mom, you know, I think I might want to go to college. And she said, you know, what are you talking about? You can't go to college. And I said, you know, I think I really want to go. I think this is something I want to do. And she said, if you try to go to college, we're going to have you locked up. So for them, these things that might seem like completely innocent, maybe even good things in other communities and other settings, were seen as really threatening to them and their way of life.
Being one of 11 children, I mean, it must have been also easy just to turn inward and be lost in that whole, not lost, but I don't know about happy, if that's the word either, but just immersed in that world and not even think about these things. It'd be very busy with brothers and sisters, very busy with the rituals of that life.
Yeah, it's a very all-encompassing life, and being part of a large family, you know, our life was very full of the services that we were involved in, our religious work and our religious lifestyle. So there wasn't a lot of space to have questions. And, of course, the repercussions of having questions or acting out were so great that few people dared to do that.
And, Leah, when you were actually exiled, or your father, your parents severed ties with you, what did that mean, first emotionally? You can go into that for us. But I just wonder, physically, where did you go? What happened to you?
So I was 16 years old. I was in Israel at the time. I had finished high school early. I was in a seminary, which is sort of like a finishing school for religious girls. and all these sort of rebellions had accumulated, and they found out I had been talking to this boy, and I also wore something they considered immodest. And that really ended my relationship with my family. I was no longer considered part of the family in the way I had been up till then. My father stopped speaking to me. They cut off their financial support. I was living in a dormitory, so I had a roof over my head, but I had to take a job as a cleaning lady to, you know, handle my other expenses. But the practical stuff wasn't as difficult as the emotional side of things, to feel like I was being ejected from this really tight-knit family, that, you know, they were just started to view me as the other. I wasn't part of them anymore. You know, a year later when I was in New York and I was talking to my mother on the phone, she said to me, "We think you must be possessed by a demon." So there was this, you know, sense that I wasn't their child anymore. I wasn't viewed with that kind of love and acceptance. I was different. I was suspect. I was potentially toxic.
Boy, Liz, I mean, what did you do? How did you function through that? It's hard enough imagining that happening to you as a, you know, fully grown adult. Here you are, you're still a teenager. I just wonder, I mean, how did you handle that from day to day, week to week?
So there were two sides of things. One is the practical. You know, at 17, I found myself in New York. I had to get a job, pay my bills, figure out how to just live my life and keep a roof over my head. And that was difficult, but it was the emotional side of things that was just, that I really fell apart on. You know, I actually did okay, practically. Like, I was never actually homeless. I went hungry, but never for too long. But emotionally, I just, my whole world had vanished, and it was such a complete world. And actually, I wasn't ready to leave it. They had kind of yanked it out from underneath me, and it was just devastating. And I turned to a lot of destructive behaviors because I didn't know any other way to cope with the intensity of what I was feeling emotionally.
Going back to the faith for a moment, I mean, there were aspects of that life and that faith that you liked.
Yes, very much.
Could you talk about that a little?
Sure. I was, you know, I loved my faith, and I loved my relationship to God. I did not want to leave my community. I did not want to find myself on my own. I was a little rebellious. I had some desires, you know, to go to college, for example, or to play a little bit with some of the expected roles of who I was supposed to be as a woman. But I was hopeful, naively hopeful, that I could do that and still be yeshivish, or at least still be part of my family, even if I wasn't part of my community. And there was just this real strict no-tolerance policy that the moment I stepped over the line, there was just no room for negotiation. There was no room for any kind of expression of religious identity other than the one they wanted me to have.
And Leah, now, I'm not sure, you're in your 30s now, so I'm trying to do a little math here and figure out how many years ago this actually happened to you. So are we talking about maybe 16 years ago now?
About, yeah, I'm 32, and most of the book happens between the ages of about 15 and 22.
And I wonder if you'd reflect on those years immediately after this happened and, you know, being immersed in a life of, you know, where there's obsessiveness about modesty, especially on the parts of the girls in the family. And what happened to you after that, and how have you processed all that out, your reaction to being expelled and the fact that you had come from this life of, you know, very cloistered and very modest way of living?
It's something I think about a lot because I am an activist now, so I'm heavily involved in these issues. And I think there are two things that really stand out to me. One is that everybody should have the right to a self-determined life. That a child or a grown up shouldn't be punished with the loss of their family because they choose a different faith than what their parents or family want. And the other thing is what you mentioned, modesty. You know, as a yeshivish girl, my life was really dominated by a pressure to remain modest. And I think, you know, I have a lot of respect for the yeshivish community and other religious communities, and I wish them the best and they should thrive. But this element of that lifestyle has to be addressed. I think what's called modesty ends up becoming a very dangerous element of a girl's identity. You know, to my mind, this modesty means that girls are sort of cut off from a sense of empowerment in their bodies. And for me, when I was thrust out in the world, that made me incredibly vulnerable. But even if you remain in that world, I find it very troubling that whole concept and how central it becomes to yeshivish girls' identities.
And that's what Footsteps and It Gets Besser is about, right?
Exactly, yeah. Footsteps is the only organization in the United States serving former ultra-Orthodox Jews who seek to explore the wider world.
Well, Leah Vincent, I'm sorry our time is so brief today, but you've certainly given us a sense of what your memoir is about, and I'm sure the memoir, this was a good experience for you to get all this out there, and now you're very active with Footsteps and It Gets Besser. Again, I'll tell folks that Leah Vincent's book is Cut Me Loose, Sin and Salvation After My Ultra-Orthodox Girlhood, one of the three books that we're highlighting in our show today because we think they're fascinating. Leah, thank you very much for coming on the air with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, good luck to you.
Thank you.
Okay. We have to take another break on our show. When we come back, we'll have our third memoir. Midday senior producer Nikki Gamer will be speaking with Misty Copeland, a world-class ballerina who rose from relative poverty to become one of the most successful American dancers working today. Just minutes before she was to walk on stage at the Metropolitan Opera House in New York, the world-class dancer Misty Copeland needed a minute to collect her thoughts. She was about to become the first African-American soloist ever to star in one of the most iconic roles for the American Ballet Theater, that of the Firebird in Igor Stravinsky's classic ballet. And it dawned on her how important that moment was. So she dedicated her performance that night to what she called the little brown girls like her, who maybe never thought that they, too, could realize such dreams. Misty Copeland writes about that moment in her memoir, Life in Motion, An Unlikely Ballerina, co-written with the award-winning journalist Charisse Jones. The memoir traces Misty Copeland's life growing up as one of six siblings in relative poverty. It wasn't until she was 13 years old, through a program at a boys and girls club, that Misty Copeland discovered ballet. And almost immediately, she was labeled a prodigy. In her memoir, she talks about how dancing became a way for her to cope with her sometimes troubling home life. She also talks about how she often struggled with her identity as one of only a handful of women of color dancing on the world stage. Midday's senior producer Nikki Gamer spoke with Misty Copeland about her rise to prominence in the dance world. And here's an excerpt from that interview.
Misty Copeland, welcome to the Midday Show. I found your memoir to be so candid and poignant, so I am thrilled that we can bring your story to our listeners.
Me too. Thank you for having me.
Okay, so I want to start with this beautiful scene you paint in your prologue. It's the night before you're set to become the first Black woman ever to star in Igor Stravinsky's The Firebird at the Metropolitan Opera House in New York. This was for the American Ballet Theater, the most prestigious ballet company in the country. You're in your late 20s. And in describing the moment, right before you walk out onto that stage, you say, "This is it. This is my moment. Finally, the moment to shine, to prove myself, to represent Black dancers at the highest level of ballet. This is for the little brown girls."
Yeah, I get emotional even hearing you read it. just because that moment was something that I think I dreamed of for so long, and I just never thought it would actually happen. To be part of American Ballet Theater and to be performing the lead part, a principal role as an African-American woman. So I think it was the first time that I was in a moment and I really realized the magnitude of it. So I'm standing backstage about to go on and knowing that there were all of these people in the audience who were there simply for what I represented, and that it was such a huge milestone for the classical ballet world to have a Black woman up there on the Metropolitan Opera House stage performing Firebird. It was just an extremely powerful, powerful moment.
Let's back up a minute, because in the book you talk about your childhood and you come from a big family that moved around a lot. And for a time for you, there wasn't much stability. Why is it that you felt the need to share this part of your story?
Mm-hmm. You know, I really wanted people to understand how I got to be the woman that I am today and that process. And, there are so many things that happened throughout my childhood that made me the little girl I was when I discovered ballet. I wanted them to understand the severity of, where I was as a child and how critical ballet was to me. And how I'm always saying that it saved my life, but I really think that it did. I think that it completely changed the trajectory of my life, and I don't know where I would be without it. So I think it was important for me to really give the details of my upbringing, because that's what made me who I am. And ballet has completely changed and matured me in a way I never thought I was capable of. When I discovered ballet, I think I was extremely underdeveloped as a child. I think I was not up to standards of where I should have been as a 13-year-old girl, just being able to really think critically about things and formulate words and share my opinion. I couldn't do any of that. I think most of my childhood, I was just trying to survive and not stand out, especially being one of six kids, you know. It was just difficult to really have an identity. So I was extremely shy and, just having the most simple of conversations, I couldn't really have. So when I found ballet, it was like it was a way that I connected to learning. I felt like it was the first time I had an identity and an escape from my everyday life at home.
Tell us a little bit more about that home life for you.
There was a lot of love in my house. My siblings and me, my mother, we were all so close. That's all we had was each other. My mom didn't really come from much family. She was adopted, and so we were hers, like we were her family. And it was really difficult for us because, you know, we were constantly struggling to be in a stable situation where we felt safe and that we had enough money to eat and a car. Like that, those were the things that I was worrying about. My worries were not, you know, what I was going to wear to school or what extracurricular activity I was going to do. It was, surviving and also keeping a secret, keeping my private life private from the kids at school. I felt embarrassed about it. So it was hard.
Let me just ask you this question. Ballet isn't something I would think would be accessible to those without means, but throughout your life, you were lucky enough to have a handful of women along the way who really mm-hmm. believed in you and pushed you toward success. And one of those women you talk about in your book is Cindy Bradley. So mm-hmm. tell us about your relationship with her.
Yeah, Cindy is such a special person. She came from a home environment where she was given opportunities, and classical ballet was one of the things that she was introduced to at a young age. And as she became an adult, she really wanted to share this art form with underprivileged communities. So through her small ballet school in San Pedro, California, she connected with the Boys and Girls Club of San Pedro, where I was a member, and she started a program to teach free classes at the Boys and Girls Club to students that wanted to come, and whoever at the end of that process she thought had the talent, she would bring into her school in full scholarship. So I was one of those students pushed into her class.
You actually lived with her family for 2 years yeah. while you were training. So tell us about that.
She really saw that I had a talent that, you know, she just could not walk away from, that she thought I could really be a great ballerina. And she knew that I, was not in the most ideal situation to get the type of training I needed. We were living in a motel at the time, me and my five siblings and my mother. She just thought it would be best for me to live with her and her husband and her son during the week so that I could really just focus on the training. She had faith that I was going to go on and be a professional. And that needed to be in the span of 4 years, which is really ambitious and unheard of, to train a classical ballerina in 4 years to go on to dance for American Ballet Theater. I owe so much to her and her family. She was not just my teacher, but she was family as well.
You know, one of the themes in your book seems to be the struggle you had between these two worlds, right? You know, Cindy's world and the world of ballet and this world of instability created by, you know, your mother in part.
It was such a struggle. You know, I think back now and I don't even know how I had it in me to completely focus on ballet with so much happening outside of it. There was a huge struggle. You know, I was falling in love with ballet and I was falling in love with Cindy and her family. And it was the first time I really felt true stability in my life. But at the same time, you know, I felt like my mom felt that she was losing me, and I wanted to, I didn't want to let her down. I wanted to, you know, still be with my family. So it was really, really, really difficult. And I've just learned so much through this process of writing the memoir and looking back and trying to understand people's actions and my mother's actions and Cindy's, and that they both loved and cared about me and wanted the best for me.
You write so beautifully about the body and about, you know, ballet as an art form. I want to know, how do you get the body in that kind of shape?
Yeah, it comes over time. That's why there aren't any shortcuts. You can't just become a ballerina overnight. You can't become a ballerina in a year. You know, the body it comes from just repetitive training. And you're kind of just banging this technique into your body over and over and over again, so that your muscles develop in a certain way, so that your bones even, you know, kind of develop in a certain way. And that's how you get the ballerina look.
Talk about that look, because there is a very specific look of a ballerina.
Yeah. Well, you definitely should have long legs, you know, a high-end step, an arched feet, flexible ankles, a slight hyperextension of the knee, which creates a really pretty line, which means it's beyond straight, so it kind of bends backwards the other way. Narrow hips and a narrow rib cage, a small bust, long arms and a long neck, and a small head. It's pretty ideal, and it's definitely not what I think a normal person would think of as beautiful. But that's kind of the proportions that a ballerina should have.
That's a lot of pressure.
Yeah. It is. I mean, that's why, you know, most dancers are selected at a young age because of their body proportions and body type to be a ballet dancer.
You talk about dancing and being on stage as having this trance-like effect on you. Mm-hmm. Can you explain for us who don't perform every day what it's like to be on stage performing in front of so many people?
For me, it was like this safe haven. From the time I started dancing, it was like the place I could be where I could just shut out all the noise. Being on stage, I no longer was being criticized. I didn't have to deal with any problems in my life. I was just up there, and I felt very safe and protected by being on the stage. But even to this day, I feel a similar way. It's just a very sacred place to be, and you're sharing this very intimate part of yourself with so many people who, for the most part, you know, they're there to enjoy themselves, so they're all there with you. And it's a very just positive and empowering experience. We go through really grueling rehearsal processes where you're constantly being criticized for every single little, you know, step you make and the way your finger, what position it's in, and the smallest details. So when you get onto the stage, it's like, oh, freedom. Like, I don't hear the words of the ballet mistresses yelling.
What are you hoping that people take away from this story?
I hope that they understand the reason I'm sharing my story. I hope to open up the ballet world to everyone. I don't think that it should be, you know, this elite form that's only for certain people. I want everyone to see the beauty in ballet and to feel that they can be a part of it.
You're doing something with Boys and Girls Club of America. Tell us about that.
Well, I was a member, and I was inducted into the Boys and Girls Club Hall of Fame. So I'm officially a Boys and Girls Club member, like family forever. ABT and the Boys and Girls Club have come together through me to create a diversity initiative called Project Plie. And it's bringing top-notch training, teachers that are trained in the ABT curriculum, to Boys and Girls Clubs all over the country, and getting training to kids in all types of communities that would never have been exposed to it. So,
and is it coming here to Baltimore?
It will be everywhere. You can go to abt.org and see specific information about Project Plie. It's pretty amazing.
All right. Well, I hope all the young women of Baltimore and Maryland are listening so they can check that out.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Well, Misty Copeland, thank you so much for joining us on the Midday
Show. Thank you very much.
Misty Copeland, the only African-American dancer with the American Ballet Theatre Company, one of the premier dancers in the country now, speaking with Midday Senior Producer Nikki Gamer. Misty Copeland's book is Life in Motion, an Unlikely Ballerina, published by Touchstone. Hope you enjoyed that conversation and all the conversations this hour of Midday Memoirs.